I know a lot of sisters, I see this in a lot of groups I'm in. Well, you know, I don't want to date any foreign men because they could be trying to get a green card, or they're just dating me because I'm American, or they on some fetish shit. And I just shake my head because I'm like, you stupid women are stopping yourselves from being loved fully, from being appreciated as a woman for the first time, for just being cherished and all this goodness that comes from that, because y'all think of somebody's on some fetish shit, or you can only date a brother bullshit, you know, all that goes along with that. And I'm just like, oh my God, it is such a fucking, it's just dumb. So, you know, any women that are on that, I can only date a brother shit, but I'm gonna go ahead and tell you, then you need to fucking keep your ass at home and date your brothers that don't want to date you, and stay the fuck single and never, I'm going here.
I'm Felina Jean, and this is Black Broads Abroad. I'm an international woman of leisure who said peace out to the United States in 2011, and I have not looked back except at this ass, honey. Since then, I've lived on 4 continents with travel to over 40 countries. Along my journey, I've come to know some very compelling Black women from all over the world who also said fuck you to their comfort zones. I created this podcast to inspire Black women in the diaspora to take risks and live their very best lives.
Phila Brown is a powerhouse world traveler, business consultant, and internet marketing coach that helps aspiring and veteran entrepreneurs build more income streams to enjoy lives of freedom. Prior to dedicating herself full-time to coaching and teaching her students, Phila Brown worked as a top executive for Fortune 500 companies like Pepsi Cola, Gateway Computers, the Walt Disney Company, and as a consultant for movie studios and entertainment companies for 18 years. In 2009, she decided to leave corporate America and her Beverly Hills lifestyle behind and pursue her passion for international travel full-time. She was able to build a new life of complete financial freedom and has since gone on to travel to over 34 countries and 130 cities, and has relocated to both Thailand for 6 months, the beautiful Dominican Republic for 4 years, where she lived her oceanfront dream life. She is currently living in beautiful Playa del Carmen, Mexico. As the creator of the Portable Business Academy, an online school that teaches how to create portable income streams to have a portable life, she's taught product creation strategies, e-commerce, how to write best-selling books on Amazon, business branding, outsourcing, and traffic generation to students all over the world that has enabled them to build lives of freedom for themselves. She can be found at www.SheilaKBrown.com. Welcome, Phila Brown.
Hey, sis, what's going on? You got me sounding all important.
Well, look, you come with the impeccable credentials. So I have to give a bit of backstory to how we even came into each other's orbit. So back in 2011, we were like the OGs of the now huge travel organization, No Madness Travel Tribe. And I think at the time, I feel like you were living in Thailand, or you were, I just know that I was like, who is this woman? She fine, she sexy, she chocolate, like she got this like impeccable corporate background. She left and she's just like doing the damn thing. I was really drawn to your energy early on, and you have become one of those friends that I call in my darkest hour when I'm about to whip somebody's ass, when I got a secret that I know ain't gonna go nowhere. So exactly. It's been a pleasure to have you in my life all of these years, so thank you for doing this interview today.
Girl, thank you for asking me, and it's been a pleasure, and it's been a blessing. So you are just my little sister, and you two are one of my core confidant crew. Ain't nothing but a couple of people, because you're a real G, and you move like a G, and you know we know how to protect each other and hold each other down and push each other up and kick each other's ass when it needs to be kicked and snatch edges and do whatever, so that we are both being our optimal selves and getting what we want to get. So it's a blessing.
It sure is. So, okay, right now I'm in Johannesburg. You're in Playa del Carmen, Mexico, and it's the midst of this crazy pandemic. So obviously, first question out the gate, like, how are you doing?
girl, I almost hate to say it, but I am thriving. It's like, oh my gosh, it's bananas. And you know, on the one hand, there's the obvious, you know, at the time of this recording, all the coronavirus and quarantine and all that stuff going down. And here in Mexico, we're officially, it's kind of hard to say officially, but probably officially about 4 weeks into our quarantine. Although my roommate and I, we started our own self-imposed quarantine like 3 weeks before that. So we're like 47 days into our own personal locking our own selves down. But you know, I'm thriving, we're thriving, we have a community of sister girls down here, and we're all thriving. But it is unfortunate because tourism has been decimated. We live in a tourist town, and you know, a couple hundred thousand people have lost their jobs, and it's really bad for the town and all that stuff. So we're praying that it all comes back, which we know that it will. But for me personally, I'm good.
And we'll actually get into that, because one of the things you do is teach people how to create portable incomes, which is more important than ever in this climate. But just to take it back a little bit, you had a very successful career as an HR executive in Los Angeles for nearly 20 years, living in Beverly Hills, all the she foo-foo bells and whistles of a wonderful lifestyle. What made you say, fuck this, I'm quitting my job and leaving the United States? And where did you go first?
Oh, Lord, that's kind of a long answer, so I'll make it short and succinct. But I've always known that, even though I didn't really have the words to articulate it or the technology to really explain it, I grew up knowing that I didn't belong where I was. So I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri in the Midwest, and I was just always so different from people. And I would see my peers and the grownups around me. It's like they all like got married and stayed in the same place. Nobody traveled. It was just like, ugh. And then even graduating high school, everybody in my high school, they pretty much all married each other, moved to the next town. People just didn't really do anything. So I left for college, went to KU, whatever. Then when I graduated that job, my first job out of school was as a flight attendant. And it was just totally by fluke that I got hired, but it was amazing. And so that's when I got my taste of travel and really what the world was like. And so I did that job for about 18 months until I got fired. And then that's when I started my little corporate career. And I began my HR career. And as you said, for 20 years, I was a top recruiting executive for top companies like Pepsi, then Gateway Computers, then the Walt Disney Company moved me out to California to do corporate stuff for them, and then Activision. And then in 2005, I was probably about 37 years old, and it was like my fourth big corporate job. I finally hit that six-figure a year, you know, salary, making really great money, living in Beverly Hills, had a ridiculously amazing life, had my sugar daddies. It was just amazing, right? And but I wasn't happy. I wasn't fulfilled. And there was like this hole that was inside of me. And in climbing the corporate ladder, particularly as a Black woman in corporate America, you pay a monumental, mind-numbing, debilitating price for everything that you do. And so I looked up, and it's now it's December 2004. And I had never taken a vacation before in my life as an adult. I'd never taken, I'm going to take a week off from work to go here. And I did like 3-day weekends or whatever, but I was really burnt out. I was having migraines. I was sick. And even though I had everything I wanted, I had the titles and I had all the crap, I was like, I can't do this. So it's December of 2004. And we were slow at the time. I was with Activision back then. And so I went in and I asked my boss December 1st, I said, hey, you know, boss person, I want to take a week off from after Christmas to the new year because we're really slow and I haven't taken any vacation. You know, is that cool? I'm letting you know that's what I'm doing. And she goes, well, I don't know that we can let you go then. And this look on her face when I asked her my time off was like, how dare you ask for your vacation? So I was just like, oh shit. So a couple weeks later, she begrudgingly allowed me to take my week off. And I remember then I was like, oh no, this ain't gonna work. So I spent that whole vacation trying to figure out how I could get off work. So I went to go see doctors, try to get up on stress leave and all these things, and it didn't work. So I went back to work on January 3rd, 2005. And as it so happened, and I was praying to God, I was like, God, please, I don't know what to do, but I can't do this. I went back to work that day. They laid off six of us. Damn. Praise Jesus. And also praise the Lord, because I was smart, because I was in HR, because I know non-melanated people, I had spent the previous 2 years kind of just gathering information and documents and things like that. So when they gave me my little what do you call it, separation agreement. They offered, I don't know, whatever little funky ass severance. But I was like, oh no, I'm gonna have my attorney look at this. And her face went white. And she was like, what? I said, oh, my attorney will look at this. So through my attorney, he let them know that I'm not to be fucked with because I knew X, Y, and Z. So I ended up walking away, long story short, with enough money to, if I knew how to budget, I wouldn't have to work for like 2 years. But because, if I just like decide to blow it, I could not work for like a year. So I got all this money. I finally got everything I asked for. Praise Jesus, I was free. And so I went on a trip. I went on a vacation. I booked a 2-week trip to London and also to Paris, my dream places to go to. And so while I was over there, I got reached out to by Paramount Studios to come and join them as a consultant. And I was like, oh my God, that was like my dream studio to work with, but I didn't know how to be a consultant. So I then started my consulting agency and they were my first client. And that's when I discovered that in being a consultant, I could make double the money I made as a stupid employee and do a quarter of the work. And so that's how I began my consulting business and my consulting agency. And I began contracting with movie studios and I hired executives for them. And so I did this for a couple of years. So what I would do is I would work 6 months, make a shit ton of money, and then I'd vacation for 6 months and go travel and blow it and go down to zero. But I knew work was plentiful. So then I get another contract, another 6-year contract, work 6 months, vacation 6 months. So that went on for like 2 years till 2008. And it's now then in 2008. And I'm still, even though I had this dream life of making all this money, I still felt this same hole that I felt before. And I'm like, well, God, what is going on? God has given me everything I've asked for. My life was just crazy amazing. It still wasn't enough. Well, at that time, I learned about making money online. There's this guy named Tim Ferriss who wrote a book called Before Our Work Week. And it was published in April of 2007. So I was getting dressed one morning and I was watching Today's Show. And he was on. And so he started talking about this book and this idea of what's called geo-arbitrage. And what that means is, and what he did is you live in a foreign country that's like a third world country, whatever. And he, in his case, he moved to Argentina. Well, the cost of living is really cheap in Argentina. You can live really, really well. And if you had a business online, making money online where you can make your American dollars, you could freaking live like a freaking queen or a king. And so I ran to a store after work. I got that book. It is a fag. So I got that book and I read it all in one night. And my life was changed from that point on. And I said, okay, God, this is what I've been looking for. This is what I wanted my whole life. I just didn't know what it was. And so I made it my goal to create that life myself. And so I started learning how to make money online and all this stuff. And so I started a little bit, was doing a little bit, doing well, whatever. And then it's so fast forward a year later, it's now the fall of 2008. And I read about this conference called the World Internet Summit. And it was in Australia. Well, it was always my dream to go to Australia. And so I was like, fuck it, I'm going. And so I quit my contract. I sold everything. And I'm like, I'm just going to move to Australia. So so the funny thing is, when you sell all your possessions, like I had over $200,000 of possessions I had spent. I had a 2-bedroom home in Beverly Hills. The closets were filled to the gills, whatever. But when you sell everything, of course, you don't get but a fraction of that stuff. So I think I only ended up with like maybe $15,000. I was like, fuck it, I'm just going to go. So I go to Australia. And it's now March 2009. And my plan was to stay over there, figure out the internet thing, and just kind of live over there. Well, I didn't do a lot of research because I was just going on my intuition. Long story short, ended up going broke, had to come back to the United States, reset up, but this was during the financial crash of 2008. So I couldn't get a job and I was like, what am I gonna do? So I spent 2 years just kind of floating around, went back to LA, ended up going totally broke still, ended up in the welfare line, 2 miles from my Beverly Hills house, was living with my girlfriend, she didn't have a job either. And then bada bing, bada boom, things turned around, started making a shit ton of money online. I got another great contract because the economy kind of turned a little bit. So I got a remote contract. And then I decided though, when I had this contract, when I was flush with my cash again, even during the broke period, the no money period, I said, I'm going to come out of this. I know that I am. And I'm going to use these skills to make money online and to create my dream life. And so even though I was broke, I was still manifesting or writing my journal. This is my dream life. I want to live in a foreign country. I want an oceanfront home. I want a thriving coaching business. I want to make money. I want to make this much money online. Everything that I wanted, I just wrote it down and I said, God, I know this is going to happen. It's going to happen. So when I was on the other side of being broke, I all of a sudden had this 6 figures of income again. My internet stuff was popping. I was like, okay, I'm going. And so I took my remote gig and I started traveling. And that's when I met you. This is in 2011 when I had my money again. And then January 2012, that's when I started this whole life I have right now, which was becoming a permanent luxury world traveler. And I moved to Thailand, moved to DR and all this stuff. So that's how I ended up kind of where I am now.
So, I mean, I like that you mentioned Tim Ferriss's book, the 4 hour work week?
The 4 hour work week.
Yeah, the 4 hour work week, because leading up to my move to Brazil, I actually was reading the same book. I used to be a college counselor in the Philadelphia school district. And I started hating my job, not the students, but just, you know, the politics. And I remember reading that book leading up to my move to Brazil, and that geo arbitrage is a real thing, ladies. Girl. That is a real thing, because luckily, like, you know, at the time, that was when Obama, when you could file for unemployment.
Right.
It was those 99 weekers, baby.
That's right.
I traveled the world on that unemployment check.
It was living large. People don't understand how well you can live, man. But we're gonna give them the tea.
We'll give them the tea. Like, but in a nutshell, I left and went to Brazil. Initially, it was with I was initially like a round trip ticket, because I hadn't been on a trip in a couple years. But maybe about 6 weeks before my trip, I was like, I'm just gonna move there. But when I tell you about the arbitrage, I had, you know, I still had some alimony money, I had some savings, and I had my unemployment. I left up on a $2 million oceanfront pad, and I was paying $600 a month for it.
Okay. No, that's right. Girl, I've had four of them bad boys.
That's stupid. It's stupid. So
it's just ignorant. It is so ignorant.
Into all of that tea later. Okay. So I mentioned in your bio you did Thailand for 6 months. How was that adjustment? And can you speak a bit more about how your money multiplied exponentially by traveling and living in places where the value of the dollar is king?
I sure can. So prior to 2012, I'm a researchaholic. I read everything. And so when I found out about, again, 2007 with Tim Ferriss and geo arbitrage, I started looking online for people that were doing this as well. And so there's a guy named Rolf Potts, R-O-L-F-P-O-T-T-S. And he wrote a book called Vagabonding, V-A-G-A-B-O-N-D-I-N-G. And he was like, it's like the grandfather of all of this. So he's who Tim actually learned from. Yeah. So I bought Rolf's book, Vagabonding, and that's where everybody got this concept from. He's not given proper credit for the stuff Tim is, but really it's Rolf. And so I started looking for people. This is back when blogs first started, and like blogs were on Blogspot. I don't know if you remember that,
Google
platform. And so I was looking for people that were doing this, and all I was seeing were white people. You know, no offense to white people, but white people, they can maneuver and navigate through the world way the hell differently than me as a single Black woman can. So I was looking for sisters that had done this, and I found a few sisters over in Paris. They had moved for love or whatever, but I just wanted some, I guess, physical validation that others that looked like me could do it. And I really wasn't finding it, but in a few sites, I said, fuck it, I'll do it, as every Black woman does, right? So fuck it, I'll just do it. So I started researching white bloggers that had gone to Thailand, because I wanted to be in Thailand. Why did I choose Thailand? Because it was one of those countries that, as I looked at countries that I knew people could live well in, and it was just, for some reason, on my bucket list. And so when I got my money in 2011, I decided to take myself over there on a birthday trip. So in November 2011, I went for 3 weeks, and I went for an internet marketing conference. That's what got me over there. And I said, I'm just going to stay and travel around and see if I like it. And so I was booking these hotels that had pools in the suites and all this crazy shit, right? And so I liked the people. So I was like, okay, I'll move here. And so I did a lot of research on what it would take. I decided to go to Chiang Mai, because at that time, a lot of digital nomads were kind of starting out there. So it's like, okay, I'll go there. Well, I left there in January 2011. I got there and I didn't care for it. I actually really hated it.
I remember
it,
that.
Enough. And so people said, why do you hate it? And that's when I discovered that I personally have to live on the ocean. I didn't know it at the time, but I knew it then. So Chiang Mai is landlocked. And also, too, it didn't have the level of luxury that I require. Now, granted, I know that it's a whole different country. So I didn't go over there saying, I need it to be like American. I'm not that kind of ignorant traveler. I knew it was going to be different, and that's fine. But every country that you go to has what I call the Beverly Hills of that area, right? Yeah. And so I was like, where is that? And so my friend who lived there, he said, well, it's here on Neiman Haven Road. And so I'm like, okay. And so I'm looking around, looking at places, and nothing really met my standards. I'm like, this isn't really what I really want to do. So my time in Thailand, when I moved there, didn't last very long. And so I went back to the States. This was now March of 2012. And I decided to travel. So I was like, fuck it. So I did 26 luxury vacations that year. I was all over Europe. I was all over everywhere. And I started thinking that I wanted to move to the Dominican Republic. Well, one of our mutual friends, she lives in Brazil, and y'all need to meet. So we finally met up in New York, reconnected, and she was like, yeah, then we went to the DR. I was like, oh my God, I am too. And so that's when I moved to the DR, sort of that particular life. But to go back to answer your question, with Thailand, I'm one of the few people that you will meet that says they hated it there. It just wasn't a fit for me. But there are a lot of benefits to living there. Number one is that it's incredibly cheap to live. The food is absolutely amazing. The people, the Thai people are really, really nice. The exchange rate is always to our favor. And so if you can, again, find a way to make those American dollars, that all you really need to live really, really well in Thailand is like $1,000 a month.
Stupidly
well. Yeah. Like,
I mean, I know,
well.
But I think the audience, I mean, like, explain
let me
$1,000.
So you can live well for like $500 a month. Now, what does that get you? That is, okay, I kind of rate things on a scale of 1 to 10. So let me give y'all a reference point here. So a level 10 living well is, I've got a luxury oceanfront crib. I got two housekeepers. I got armed security. My shit is like, if it was in the States, it would be like 15, 20 G's a month to rent in Malibu. That's level 10. That's okay. What I scaled up to.
Okay.
Living well on like a regular would be, I have a really nice condo in, let's say, Atlanta. It's in a high rise. It's in a good area. I'm paying $1,500 a month for this condo. It's got some amenities, whatever. It's a nice spot. Nobody would ever be like, oh, you living foul. It's like, no, it's a nice spot. So that equivalent in Thailand, I could have found it for, say, $500, maybe $600 a month. It would have been in a high rise, brand new American style building, rooftop pool, gym, all that stuff, easily in Chiang Mai, Thailand at the time, for like, really, I don't know folks that had that same joint for like $350 a month, like real talk. But $350, you might have a one bedroom, $500, you've got a two bedroom.
Geo-arbitrage, ladies and gentlemen.
Geo-arbitrage, y'all, I'm telling you. But if you're making $1,000, oh, you'd be like, hell, I can't even spend this much. Because yeah. This is like, your shit would be so dope. It's crazy. Especially, and then, you know, you get a little now. Scooter to get around on and all that stuff. But yeah, so that's geo-arbitrage, like legit. So, and for countries, for people that may want to know that, what are good countries to do that in? Thailand is definitely amazing to do it. If you need the ocean, just go south and move to a Phuket or Koh Samui, places like that. Now, if you're in Koh Samui, where it's beautiful, you're on the water, it's going to cost you a little bit more because you've got wealthier expats that live there. So for me to have my super dope spot in, say, Koh Samui, I may spend $1,200, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, yeah, so that's Thailand.
Wow. So, okay, fast forward. We don't have to go over every place, but you also lived in the Dominican Republic for 4 years. And I want to talk through a little bit of that experience. And if you could I remember that you had some health issues that you faced while there. So what was that experience like? Like being away from home, you've created this dream life for yourself, and then boom, you get sick.
Yep. So the DR was amazing. So I said, I want to go there too. So we both just said, well, let's just go together, because she was a nomad as well. And so we went down. I charged her with finding our first place. And so she sent me some Airbnb pictures. And the first place we got, it was like something out of Architectural Digest. Like when you walk into it, everybody's reaction was, oh my God. So we had this three bedrooms, three baths, all decorated like out of Architectural Digest, on the water. And it was interesting. So we moved there and I realized, we've been there like a month, and I realized that a journal entry that I wrote when I was broke in 2010, I wrote down exactly what I wanted. And I looked up and I literally was living what I wrote verbatim. I had a thriving coaching business. I had this beautiful home. We were on the water. I walked on the beach every day. I had this money coming in, you know, blah, 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 blah. It was amazing. So I manifested my dream. And I was really, I didn't know this literally until a few years later, but her leaving, because we were so tied and so connected, it sent me into a depression tailspin that I didn't know that I was in at the time. And so she left February 2013. The next month in March, I started noticing that I was having like vision problems. And so I was like, what the hell? And I noticed a numbness in my, on my left hand and my ring finger, my pinky finger was like a tingling. So I'm like, oh my God, what the hell? So I'm Googling shit, right? Doing Dr. Google, which you should never do. But I was like, oh my God, do I have it? It was like symptoms of MS. Do I have that? Was it pre-diabetes? What was going on? And so I was terrified because I'm in the DR. They only speak Spanish. I didn't speak Spanish, right? I didn't know a lot of people, but I did meet a girlfriend there who was American, and she took me to the hospital, whatever. And so I got tested. I didn't have diabetes. They didn't know what I had, to be honest with you. And after about a month, those symptoms went away. So I don't know really what happened, but I was like, whatever. But I was also at the time really stressed out. I was having bad anxiety and I was under a lot more stress than I realized, because one of the things that I didn't know, again, until like 4 years later, being in a foreign country as a single woman, I don't have a job. Everything I do, I got to figure out for my money and everything. It's a ridiculous amount of stress and pressure. And I'm the kind of woman where I'm strong. I don't have time to be like wallowing. I just got to figure shit out. And so it was constant. Figure it out. How am I getting money? What am I doing? Got to keep myself safe. You know, all the things. And over time, and I kept leaving from the DR, kept leaving and going back. And so 4 years later, on my last trip, when I moved back this last time, I moved to a whole new town. Right before I left, I was staying in Dallas for a little brief period of time, and I kind of developed some lower back issues. So about a month later, when I moved to the DR, I got there. It was June 30th of 2016, and my back was killing me. And so I got there, and within the first like 10 days of being there, I found myself, I was in a whole new town. I didn't know anybody in this new town. I found myself completely immobilized. My back issues had gotten so bad that I couldn't stand more than 10 minutes. And so I found myself for 3 weeks. I was totally in a foreign country, in a new home that I didn't know anybody in. I couldn't walk. I couldn't get around. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Well, I happened to meet a woman when I first got there. This is when none but God. When I was able to walk, I went to a July 4th celebration, and she was a lady who was married to an American man, but she was Dominican, and she was really nice. And she goes, keep my information if you ever need anything. So week two into this whole I can't walk thing, I was like, God, what am I going to do? And I was suffering in silence because I didn't want to tell anybody, like my friends, because they all would have been like, come home. And I just felt like I didn't want to leave. And turns out I had sciatica. And so three of my spine, lower vertebrae had compressed, and there was like no cushion between them. And so I had sciatica. But really what it turned out to be was I had manifested so much stress that stress manifested this illness. It manifested 4 years before with that whole, I can't see and I can't feel anything, but then it went away, and then manifested again with this whole, oh, you're not going to be able to walk, because it was God telling me, you need to like do something different because this is how what's going to happen. So I went back to the States and all that stuff. But that was my being ill abroad like twice. And I'll wrap all that around the fact that I was in a low grade, but still fairly manic depression.
You know, so oftentimes like traveling and being expat is glamorized and people forget like life happens every fucking where. It happens everywhere. Like, you know, being, you know, living abroad and having this like sort of expat lifestyle, it doesn't render you like immune from a real life shit that happened. So I'm glad that you actually mentioned depression, because that's something that you and I both deal with. And it's not something that I like, I talk about openly because, well, I don't fuck with that many people anyway. So it's not a
common. Right.
We share that in common. For sure.
Yeah, we do.
For sure. So it's not something that I've had like candid, open discussions about, much less on a platform like this. But I think it's important, you know, to be vulnerable sometimes. So like I've contended personally with depression probably since I was an adolescent. And it's not persistent in the sense that I deal with it every day, but every few years it comes. And sometimes it comes and stays and lingers, and it's been debilitating at times. So this is a twofold question. As an expat, how have you dealt with your depression, being isolated and so far removed from your loved ones? And also that dreaded reverse culture shock that leads to depression for many expats that return to the United States after, you know, being gone for a length of time.
Yeah. So, okay. Ask me the first question again.
So the first question is, as an expat, how have you dealt with your depression, being isolated and so far removed from your loved ones?
Okay. Let me answer that one. And then ask me the second one when I finish this one, because I'm going to forget that one because that's a big one too. So just like you, I've dealt with this depression thing since I was 13. And back then I just remember feeling like I'll call it feeling blue. Because there really weren't words for depression back when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, even in the 90s, like it wasn't a thing. And so I just remember one day, I just felt kind of blue. And I was a happy kid. I don't have any, you know, no stories, anything like that, praise God. I would feel kind of blue for like 2 weeks and then it would go away. And I'd be like, oh, okay. That was in 13, but then I remember it happening again when I graduated college and I was like 22, 23. And I felt blue. I was like, oh my God, here's that blue thing. I feel blue again. And this lasted like 3 weeks. And it was just kind of low grade. I just kind of felt not myself. And then it went away. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. Fast forward 2009. Now I had just gotten a really great job with Gateway Computers and they relocated me to San Diego, which was my dream. I was out of Kansas City. I had this great job. I was finally able to move and do this thing. So I got to San Diego, new city, didn't know anyone. And then it hit me, this loneliness hit me. And I had never been, I'm an only child. And like you, I don't like people. Yeah. I entertain myself as only children. We don't want people around us. We're good. We can isolate, like this whole isolation thing and quarantine. I've been training my whole life for this. I'm like, thank you, Lord. So it's like, but I found that I was lonely for the first time. And I remember this as clear as day. It was like a shift. It was like an energy shift. It was like, boom. And that's when the depression clicked on. Again, it was undetected for like 18 months. I didn't know it, but that's when it started. And so, it was a manic depression. It was like, oh my God. But again, I didn't know that I was in it, but it was horrific. And so I didn't come out of it until actually it was November of the following year that it just went away. And I said, oh my God, that was so bad that if I ever get depressed like that again, I won't survive it. And B, I will have to go and get some kind of help or medication. Cause I'm very anti-medications. I don't believe in antidepressants. I don't believe in none of that shit. Right. So, but I said, if it happens again, I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to have to do something because I literally won't survive. So when the depression hit, when I moved abroad again, I didn't know it. It was so low level. And it started because, you know, I moved to a foreign country, and everything that I did it all. It's what I wanted. It was my dream. So I'm living in a foreign country. I don't speak the language. I live in a gated community. So I isolated upon isolation upon isolation. And that choice was very deliberate. And all my travels up to that point had been solo travel. It's what I wanted to do. But what I didn't understand is that making those decisions, it's incredibly debilitating. And you don't know it until you're on the other side. And so doing it again, I've made other choices that keep me from it. I'll talk about that later on. But you just start to spiral. And so being an expat, it's really important to not be alone, to not isolate. You've got to make yourself get out. You got to make yourself meet people. And as an introvert, that's hard to do, but you really have to do that. You've got to build a community. You've got to be involved. And I didn't do any of those things. And that is, again, people don't talk about this part. You know, being an expat is hella dope and it's amazing and it's awesome. But like you said, life happens. And when you have to face the struggles of, oh shit, you know, I got to make money, or I have to constantly be on guard to keep myself safe as a single woman or whatever, people don't realize that that's literally a 24/7 thing. Every decision that I make has to do two things. It's got to support my lifestyle with the money, whatever, and it's got to protect me. And that is so much pressure. It's tough. Yeah, you got to map the dot as clear as the dog. The time. And so I spiraled and it was a lot. And so if I had to give any advice to women that are thinking about being an expat, number one, do it. Please please just fucking do it, because you don't discover things about yourself until you're out there. I wouldn't have discovered that I need community until I didn't have community. I wouldn't have discovered that, oh, I'm a bitch, I gotta have a motherfucking ocean, until I moved to a place that didn't have the ocean. I wouldn't have discovered how strong and resilient I am until I had to be strong and resilient. I discovered that I can come from having $2.10 to my name and then to come out of that until I had to do it.
In a real way? You are not.
In a real way. Wow. In a real way. And so I'm kind of going off topic for a hot second, but I know a lot of women that want to do this. They're like, I'm so afraid because what if I go broke? Or what if something happens to me? What if I get sick? What if ... Well, I had all that shit happen to me, and you just figure shit out. You know what I mean? And so, but not one time did I ever say, I really wish I shouldn't have, or I could, not one decision do I regret, or do I say, no, I shouldn't have. And it's because I just got up there and did it. So the depression thing, it's just something you got to manage. You really have just got, you got to be aware of it, first of all. And it's really interesting because when I was in this last 4-year stint, I would always ask myself, because I knew what it was like in 2009, am I depressed? And I'd be like, so I'll do my little check. No, I feel happy. No, I'm good. So I was constantly checking my little check marks. So everything was always like, no, I'm not depressed. And, but it was such a low grade, but I really was. But you know, that's how that was. And so to your second question, the reintegration piece, oh my God. So when you leave a foreign country and you come back to the United States, that will send you spiraling into a fucking depression.
Oh my God, because
you're living in these places, you see how other people live, you see how happy people are, how much you don't need things that we have in the States. You just realize how real people live and how much joy you can have. And then you go to the States and you see all the fuck shit and the bullshit and the things that people think are important, which really aren't. Oh my God, I just want to take a gun and shoot myself. When I went back for the first time in 2014, when I was depressed, I literally had thoughts of killing myself at least 82 times between February and September 2014. Because it was just like, oh, this is some bullshit. Thankfully, I didn't do it, because I'm strong enough to not do that, but it just kept coming up. I'm gonna kill myself, but this is just some fuck shit. So
2014,
it was terrible. That United States stuff is like, it is not the business. So yeah, and it got so bad, Felina, that in September or something, like it would be like, oh my God, the sun isn't shining, I'm gonna kill myself. It was like, it became the default. And so finally I had to tell myself, bitch, if you say that shit one more motherfucking time, but you need to go on and fucking do it. And I was real serious, like, just fucking, but if you don't do it, then you cannot say that one more time. You cannot think it. It is not a fucking option. So what are we gonna do? You're gonna fucking kill yourself or you not? What the fuck are we gonna do? And so I was like, okay, I'm not ready to go. And so then ever since that point, I've never had that thought, never had it as an option. And it was like, no, but it just became this automatic default. It was crazy. It was insane.
It's crazy because, you know, you already know this because when I was going through this past time, re-entering back into the United States and then just like losing all of my norms, like just everything just went by the wayside. Girl, I had to have the same conversation with myself. I looked dead in the mirror at myself like, you gonna be a stand-up hoe or a fall-down bitch? Which one is gonna be? Because we not gonna do this. We not gonna crawl in bed, much less over a bitch. Because you know it was exactly. A relationship. Like, the relationship, you know, I lost my six-figure lifestyle, you know, private island living and coming back to the United States. It was some bullshit. And I mean, I have not confessed this publicly, like probably to anybody other than like, you know, my dad, my grandparents, my mom, they were like really concerned about me, but I really thought about ending it. I was like, I was actively thinking about how I wrote a suicide note. Like I was done. I was, and you know how debilitating it is? The fucking mind tricks that you can play with yourself because I mean, I was in the United States and I totally felt homeless because I mean, I was basically like living with a chick. And I mean, you know, my home for all intents and purposes was here in South Africa. And I sat in the fucking bed and cried and wanted to die for like 3.5-4 months, maybe longer. And I had this place that whole time, the whole time, and I didn't even consider it as an option. I couldn't even think past getting out of the bed. Wow. And I have to thank you because sometimes like we feel each other because I remember I was in the car and I was like, what's up with Sheila? What's up with Sheila? It was right when I was about to make the leap. I think it was 2018. It was right when I was about to make the leap and come back to the United States.
It was September of 2018.
It was
August. It was August of 2018.
Okay, yeah, it was August. Yeah, because I left in September. But I was feeling you. I was feeling you. You are like you. I mean, we all sound like we like kiki on the phone and shit every single day. But when we talk, it's for a goddamn reason. Thank you for being that vulnerable. But the re-entry is hard. I remember one time when I came back in 2012 and re-entered, I went to mind you, I could find a job. Alimony ran out. Savings ran out. Them 99 weeks, them Obama unemployment checks.
Right, right.
I was in the farmer's market. I was living in Charlotte at the time. And, like, the avocados was $2 for $5. Girl, I started bawling. I was bawling.
Because you're like, these motherfuckers are 30 cents in Brazil.
I was inconsolable, girl. Like, it just be the weirdest moments that this shit hit. I was inconsolable. I was like, oh my God, I could buy like so much. I could practically buy my produce for the week with $5.
People don't know. And that $5 produce is all organic. Because they don't have that GMO stuff in these foreign countries. That's the other thing, too.
Okay. I want to talk about dating a little bit. We're going on an upper, okay? Fuck that depression shit. You know, the moral of that story was, like, you got to check yourself and have the hard conversations with yourself. Like,
and I'll add to that. You got to have it with yourself, but you also have to have people in your life that are like you and that are your fucking G's that, because you and I, we're the same, we're so equally yoked, it's crazy. But you and I are the same in which we're both very strong. We don't want to burden people with our shit, right? And so, but if somebody didn't call us, we cuss like, bitch, why the fuck didn't you tell me, blah, blah, blah. But we aren't giving up anything. And so you got to have people in your life that A, you give carte blanche to call you on your shit. B, that you have a real spiritual connection with so that if you call me, Sheila, girl, how you doing? And I put up my automatic, the deflection, oh girl, I'm good, how you doing? Get it off of me real quick, because I'm the queen of that stuff. Yeah. You need to know that person, well enough to know, nah, bitch, Just like when you called me in August of 2018, you and I, we hadn't talked in a minute. And at that moment, I was at a super low, like I was in a super, super low time. And I didn't tell my best friend I was living with in Texas. Like I couldn't talk to anybody, I didn't tell anybody. And you were like, nah, girl, like what's up? And I was walking and I finally just started crying because it was too much to hold shit in. You were just saying it out loud, save my life. And then you listened to me and you gave me some great suggestions and everything. And literally everything turned around like right in that moment.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Remember?
Because I remember like calling you, probably it might not even been a week later, and it was like, huh, is this the same person?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so really work to, if you are that strong friend, you know, and us as Black women in particular, you know, we feel like we don't have anybody we can rely on or whatever. You need to get people in your life that would be like, nah, girl, what's really going on? And you've got to not be afraid to share, not be afraid to be vulnerable. Because if I would have just said, oh, no, Felina, I'm good, and done my master Sheila actress, you know, deflection, I wouldn't have got the help that God was sending me through Felina to get calibrated and then to change and then do all these things that happen too. So that's the other piece that I would put into that. If you do decide to take on this life, do not take this life on alone. You've got to have people that, you know, you're reaching out to and you're getting help from and that you're helping to reciprocally.
Yeah, that's true. You've talked me off the ledge a couple times because I'm going to whip your homegirl's ass. And I have real rap in a real way.
I know.
Yeah, in a real way.
I know.
And you have definitely talked me off. That's how I knew that, you know, I had taken ayahuasca like maybe about 3 months before that. That's when I knew that it had worked. That is what I did. I just had to start praying, but you, thank you. Thank you for being my
girl.
Thank you.
Girl, I love y'all both. That, yeah. Hey.
So, okay.
You know what? I think I'm the only one of my crew that has not done that. All my traveling homegirls, all you have done it, and I haven't done it. I don't know that I will, but this is interesting. So
it calls you. Like, when it's your time, it calls you. Yeah, it calls you. So dating, onto a bit of a higher note. This might have to be on a Patreon thing because this.
We'll do the rated G version of the dating.
Okay. So, okay, you have had some quite riveting dating stories from being a kept woman in Beverly Hills and dating globally. What experiences can you share on the courtship differences in dating a gamut of men from around the world?
For sure. So this is a good question because, again, from the perspective of I'm a single Black woman and I'm traveling the world looking for two things, my home and my man. The one thing I would implore you to do is to suspend any expectations, any thoughts, any of your must-haves and your non-negotiables and really any other shit that you think you know about dating men, leave that shit where it is before you get on a goddamn plane. I don't give a damn. I ain't paying for no dates. I don't go Dutch. Motherfucker, you gonna pay. Well, in a lot of countries, Australia as an example, that's not done. Switzerland, that's not done. A lot of European countries, they just go Dutch on shit, right? So I discovered this when I moved to Australia in 2009. I was meeting these amazing men and, you know, we'd go to pay or whatever. And I'm just sitting there and I'm just like, cause I don't want my wallet or whatever. Well, this one guy that I was dating, he was like, well, you know, Sheila, you know, men don't typically pay for dates. We usually go Dutch. And I was like, oh really? Well, in America, men pay. So I'm gonna need you to go ahead and work that out. But I duly know that what you just said, so for the next time, I'll know that, but work it out, bruh. And so he did, ding, ding, ding. I can't take my American Sheila-ness and all my, and be expecting this shit. So now granted, I still ain't paid for no motherfucking dates, but you know, but it was something that we realized. And even like, even in France, like men don't pay for dates. And so I was like, okay, fine. And so, but I attract men that pay for dates, but I had to remind myself that if I do meet a man and it comes out to be Dutch, no big deal. It's a cultural thing. It's not a big deal. So I'd be okay with it. I date primarily, you know, Caucasian men whenever I date. And so that's been easy. That's been a lot of fun. When I was in Australia in the 5 months that I was there, I dated more in those 5 months than I dated for years in the United States. It was incredible. So the thing I love about men and traveling is that they look at me as a woman first. Like when I was in Australia, okay, let me go back. I'm talking all over the place. So being in America, the one thing I've come to understand is that as a Black woman, everything that we do is filtered through race. So if somebody looks at me funny, it's because I'm Black. If they say something, it's because I'm Black. So after when I was till I moved to Australia and I meet men, meet people, and they all saw me as a woman first and then American. And then it stopped after that. And so it was like, oh my, it was a huge mind fuck for me to be viewed like I'm a woman just like everybody else. I had never had that happen before. Mm. And so, and I allowed men to treat me as a woman, and it was just really beautiful. And it was nice to not have this, oh, she's a Black woman, you know, blah, blah, blah. It just didn't come up. And so that's why I love dating foreign men. And that's been my experience in all the countries I've dated in. They see me as a woman and then American, and then the whole Black thing literally never comes up. I know a lot of sisters, I see this in a lot of groups I'm in, well, you know, I don't want to date any foreign men because they could be trying to get a green card, or they're just dating me because I'm American, or they on some fetish shit. And I just shake my head because I'm like, you stupid women are stopping yourselves from being loved fully, from being appreciated as a woman for the first time, for just being cherished and all this goodness that comes from that, because y'all think of somebody's on some fetish shit, or you can only date a brother bullshit, you know, all that goes along with that. And I'm just like, oh my God, it is such a fucking, it's just dumb. So, you know, any women that are on that, I can only date a brother shit, but I'm gonna go ahead and tell you that you need to fucking keep your ass at home and date your brothers that don't want to date you, and stay the fuck single and never. I'm going here. Let me stop this.
No, go ahead. I want you to go all the way in. Go ahead. Because
this is like a hot button for me. Because my biggest purpose in life is, and you know this about me, is for Black women to live their highest fucking life. I want us all to win. I want us to be loved. I want us to get our bag. I want us to experience everything that is for everybody else and know that it's for us. And the biggest thing I want us to experience is just being loved fully. Having someone look at you and see your beauty and like be speechless. And to approach you from that speechless standpoint to the point where you're like, okay, wait, what the fuck? Like, so you're like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. And so it becomes a mind fuck for us because we're not approached that way. And you think something wrong with me, and you go into this whole thing, and then you realize, okay, wait, like he thinks I'm pretty, he thinks I'm beautiful. So there's this whole mental gymnastics that we have to go through to release all the fuckery that we have carried since we were little fucking brown babies that is put on us, that tells us that we're not pretty, we're not desirable, when in the truth of the matter is, globally, we are the most desired women. We are the most strive for women. And I want Black women to appreciate that. But you've got to suspend all of the fuck shit before you get to that space. And when you do realize and you open yourself up to it, it is as gratifying, it's glorious. And you know, you fucking do it some other countries, and oh girl, it's amazing. It's so amazing. So that was my little rant. That was my rant.
You know, I do agree with you on, I think that Black women have a debilitating devotion to Black men that is not reciprocated. I do believe that. Really and truly, for the most part, obviously,
for the most part, we're generalizing. Yeah, obviously,
definitely. So
nobody out there talking about, well, that's not my experience. We are speaking obviously as like a blanket statement. I hate that I have to like say that as an asterisk, but this is a blanket statement, right? So
it is. And I have a great deal of respect for Black men. My Black father raised me, and I come from five generations of Philip Knappers that never abdicated their responsibilities as Black men. So let me get that part out of the way. But at the same
time, while you're on that, let me say the same thing too. I love leathers. In fact, people don't know this about me, but I love dark chocolate men. It's like, oh my goodness, my man here in Mexico, dark chocolate Jamaican. So people, I think they look at me and they're like, oh, well, you don't like Black men. That's not true. Just because you prefer or date another race, that has something to do with another race too. So I want to put that out there too. I don't want anybody to misconstrue my thoughts and my feelings on stuff, but I also choose to see the writing on the wall, and I choose to not limit myself in any way, shape, or possible stance. So I open myself up to everybody. So that's it.
I love it. So, okay. You actually help people, as I mentioned earlier in the show, that you help people to create portable income streams and also provide entrepreneurship coaching. One notable, mm-hmm. Claire Suarez of Up in the Air Life. You were her first coach, and she's since turned her boutique travel company into a million-dollar brand. So how did you get into this kind of work, and how do you see your work fitting in this new pandemic and post-pandemic world?
Excellent question. So I got into it because I spent over $100,000 plus, you know, learning how to do this stuff. And so back when I first started traveling back in 2009, even 2008 on this internet money and stuff, I'd be sitting up at first class. I'm always sitting up next to some white man because nobody else is Black, right? And so the first thing out of their mouth is, oh, so what do you do for a living? Right, trying to count my coins. And so my answer was, well, I'm on my 29th vacation, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh my God, how do you do that? And I said, and my answer always was, it's because my incomes are portable. Because I make money online, because it's not tied to a JOB or physical location, as long as I have the internet and some kind of little computer, I can make money. That's just how it is. So the portable income thing came about, and I always wanted to create a course telling people, teaching people how to do this too, how to monetize the knowledge that's in our brains that you can put into a course or other things, and people will pay you for that. And so when I was living in the DR, I brought it up to her, and I was like, I always want to do this thing. You want to do it with me? So we launched Portable Incomes together. And then I said, I always want to do coaching. You want to do that too? And so we started coaching, and Claire was one of our clients, other people too. So that's how the coaching came about. And we started seeing these results in these women that we were coaching, these Black women in particular. They were starting these businesses. They were able to get themselves out of corporate America because they were able to profit from the knowledge that they had in creating these businesses. And so I love coaching. I love creating courses to teach people how to do the things that I know how to do. And it's all about, my whole thing is, make your incomes portable. So now that we're now here in this pandemic time, you know, how many millions of folks overnight are now out of a job because they made the mistake of having one income source and an income source that is active, meaning you're trading your hours for dollars. Well, now people are realizing, so you really have to know kind of the lifestyle you want to have for yourself and then reverse engineer it to figure out then, okay, what's going to work for you to make money online? Because there's so many ways to do it, ways that work, ways that don't work, ways that you can make a shit ton of money quickly, ways in which it's really slow, ways that are passive, ways that are active. There's lots of ways to do that. And that's what helps people actually get clear on, is figuring out what it is they want to do and then the resources to get it done.
That's excellent. So what's the biggest lesson that you have learned about stepping outside of your comfort zone?
God, good question. The biggest lesson I've learned to step outside of my comfort zone is that I have everything that I need. I am a favored daughter of God, and God has given me everything. And it really is a matter of me having faith in myself and faith in Him, not putting me someplace in which I couldn't figure my way out of. And so I think the biggest lesson continuously, this is what I constantly work on, is trusting myself, having faith in myself. And so the times in my business in which I had become faithless, that means that I'm too scared to do something and I stop working. Well, when I stop working, I don't make money, right? And so it's like, oh shit. And so I constantly have to just realize that I have an amazing skill set. it is valuable. And then this thing called imposter syndrome comes up that people don't talk about enough.
Yeah.
Imposter syndrome, particularly for women, is the biggest debilitating stopper of people, because you're like, and imposter syndrome, for those that don't understand what it is this feeling that what I'm doing out in the world, it's coming to me really easily. I'm having success with it, but it can't be this easy. So therefore I must be a fake. Therefore I'm an imposter. And so you live in fear of this entity coming in saying, oh, you really don't know how to do that, and calling on your shit and like embarrassing you, even though you really do. And so those of us that are successful, the success comes easy to, it hits up. You want to put a gun to your head. It's just so hard to believe. You got to keep doing it. But what happens to most of us is we stop because the voices in our head are like, you can't really do this. You're fooling people. People are going to find out you're a fraud or whatever, even though you're not. And so you don't do anything and you become paralyzed.
So what's next for you, and where can people keep up with your journey on social media?
So what's next for me is still living here in Mexico. I moved here in November of last year and I love it and I'm super happy. And I've been looking for my home for the past 11 years and I found it because Mexico is so amazing. So next for me is getting temporary residency here, getting a place and staying the fuck in Mexico because life is just too good. From a business standpoint, oh gosh, doubling down on my e-commerce stuff, getting my income up to 6 figures a month over the next 12 months, which will be amazing. Coming out with new products, helping more people, finally building a brand that is around me, and just helping more people. People need my help more than ever, and just really choosing to be a vessel in that space. Social media, I don't do a lot of Instagram because I think my life is kind of boring, so that may change, I don't know. But I'm really a Facebook girl. So on Facebook, I'm Sheila.Brown2. And then my website is SheilaKBrown.com, S-H-E-I-L-A, the initial K, B-R-O-W-N.com. So that's me.
Thank you so much for your time.
Shout out to our Patreon members. Thank you so much for your support. If you too are interested in supporting the Black Broads Abroad movement, keep up with us on social media, and that's at Black Broads Abroad, BlackBroadsAbroad, and that's on IG and Facebook. And if you're interested in supporting on Patreon, visit www.patreon.com/BlackBroadsAbroad.